Welcome to the Pragati Podcast and our World Environment Day special episode. Lawyer Ninad Lord, who practices in India's Supreme Court and the National Green Tribunal, returns to the Pragati Podcast today to tell us about how India's judicial and legal protections for the environment have changed in the last 2 years. Ninad was here earlier in episode 73, where we spoke about the evolution of the public interest litigation and the role that the Indian courts have played on the environment since the 1990s and even earlier. We spent 15 minutes in this new recording talking about how things have changed in the last 2 years, and then I'm sharing our older episode from December 2018, which makes for essential listening this World Environment Day. Welcome to the Pragati Podcast, a weekly talk show on public policy, economics, and international relations. We take a step back from noisy political debates and dive into rich conversations on India and the world. I am your host, Pawan Srinath. We'll start this episode's conversation after a short break. Hi, Ninad. Welcome back to the Pragati Podcast for our World Environment Day episode.
Hi, Pawan. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure entirely. Back in December 2018, we had discussed at length about the role that the Indian judiciary has played in environmental protection in the country. We talked about what's been happening since the 90s and 2000s and now. One of the things that we spent quite a bit of time talking about was the creation and the working of the National Green Tribunal. Since our recording, in May 2019, Maya Ramesh wrote an article in The Wire saying that the National Green Tribunal is losing its bite, that from a judicial body, it's becoming more of an oversight body, which is delegating some of its function to empowered communities and perhaps becoming weaker in its role. Now, we are sitting here in June 2020 as we are getting out of the lockdown and we're still in the middle of the pandemic. Would you agree with this assessment that the NGT isn't what it used to be?
I think the article does capture a lot of things that are indeed happening. But I would add that perhaps there is a bit of overgeneralization in the article. If I go by all the observations, I mean, this is a widely circulated, widely read article. And from what I can remember, it largely targets the manner in which the hearings happen and the manner in which committees are formed and cases disposed. To me, that is not necessarily bad, because I think there are some positives to it and some negatives to it. It is a fact that the trend has been of the NGT to have committees look at fact-finding. The positive of that, I think, is that the NGT has been able to focus on some very serious, larger issues. So the NGT has, over the last couple of years, picked those issues, then formed committees, and then gone ahead with doing what it has done. The negative that I see from this is, yes, as the article says, sometimes the committee does tend to get more importance and more power than it should. In law, under the Civil Procedure Code, for instance, we have a concept of a local commissioner or a court commissioner, which is a person who is appointed by the court as a fact-finding body, who does some fact-finding and returns a report to the court. And the court then does its own assessment and also then adjudicates on the dispute. There has perhaps been a tendency of relying a bit too much on the findings of the committee, so much so that it is believed or there is a perception that the committee's findings are final and that itself will determine what the outcome of the case in the NGT is. I think to that extent, the article is surely right. Something that the article doesn't really touch upon, and I think is a negative fallout from this, is that as much as the broad issues are picked up by the NGT or the macro level sort of identification of environmental issues is being done by the NGT. The problem with this sort of method of having a committee identify what is happening in a larger area, say a state or say the whole country, where, for instance, the Central Pollution Control Board is asked to give a report and then the NGT decides. The problem with that is that the individual industries that will eventually bear the brunt of the consequences or the directions of the tribunal aren't really heard. And what really happens is that post the committee's reports, the NGT tends to direct the pollution control boards, which actually are the regulatory bodies and the individual states, to act. Now, the tendency that I have seen personally is for the pollution control boards to, in a knee-jerk reaction, send notices for closure to all and sundry, whether they are actually violating or not. So the trouble here is someone who is actually following the law and actually meticulously complying with norms that have been laid down for the industry are also subjected to this entire exercise.
So in a way, does that mean that the formation of these committees that report to a judiciary, first of all, this is new for me because typically we hear about committees which report to some government or executive authority, right? So that the executive can form policies better. Now, you're saying that this process might be resulting in more one-size-fits-all orders and judgments that are coming out?
Yes. What the article is trying to stress is that earlier the NGT would take up individual cases of violation, hear the person against whom the allegations are, and then decide a case. The trend now is to have a committee look at a larger issue, let's say of groundwater or solid waste management, and then based on the findings of the committee for an entire state or for an entire region, the NGT then passes orders. So the problem there is, of course, of a broad brush and a broad sweep with which the observations, directions, and the orders are made. But I must add that committees aren't completely unknown to this process. The Supreme Court, for instance, as I'd mentioned in the previous podcast, has had something called as the Central Empowered Committee, which is a committee that was conceived by the Supreme Court itself to actually do a similar fact-finding on various larger, broader environmental issues and give it a report. And the Supreme Court has, for over 20 years actually now, or close to 20 years, done its adjudication on environmental issues, largely based on reports of the CEC. So they're not completely unknown to the process. At the same time, a lot of times, because they're broad observations on a topic, the person who will eventually have a closure order, for instance, coming his way, is really kept out of the process.
Okay. So in a sense, we are seeing a new version of the older problem, right? From our previous discussion, we spoke about how the courts were trying to act on case after case, but there were so many that were piling in that the judicial innovation was to look at this problem in a more systemic manner, right? And we are seeing a different version of that happen now with its own unforeseen consequences.
Yes.
Nina, the other thing we visited back in 2018 was that the NGT in 2018 at the end of the year was a body which did not have full appointments. So not all of its benches were sitting and convening and were able to, the processing power of number of cases and so on had reduced. Has this changed now in 2020?
Well, it's an interesting situation. So because there were no appointments made, the regional benches of the NGT, which were located in Bhopal, Pune, Calcutta, and Chennai, could not function and didn't function for the longest time. The Chennai bench, in fact, resumed functioning only a few months before the lockdown. So there have been appointments now, but they happened just before the lockdown. And now because of the lockdown, again, so we've had almost close to 2 years that these regional benches haven't really functioned, which isn't very good. But the positive that has come out of it, or rather the silver lining from this, is that while today all the courts across the country are scrambling to adopt the new technology and have video conferencing to conduct their hearings while dealing with the present situation, the NGT was a pioneer of sorts in this because they realized that they could not really man these regional benches, or they wouldn't have the numbers to have judicial and expert members in these benches. They adopted the video conferencing facility over a year back, which may not have been ideal, but at least it gave a start for something which has now been adopted by everyone.
That's wonderful to hear. And I remember from our conversation a while ago that while online discussions and online hearings were a good thing, they were still not providing a level playing field between people who could attend a hearing and argue in person versus argue online. And now, so there is perhaps a new equality, right, where everybody has to argue online. So there is no geographical preference.
True. There is parity now because everyone has to basically argue over a video conferencing app.
Ninad, we are recording this on Zoom, and I'm sure in a couple of hours you'll have to dive back into court hearings from a similar software. What has been your personal experience in this? How is it like to argue online? How do you feel as a lawyer? Are you able to make your case as strongly? Is there an evolution that you're seeing in the proceedings?
My experience has largely been positive. I think hearings are a lot more disciplined. Hearings are a lot more systematic. I think we can make our point clearly. The trouble, though, is that the logistics surrounding this aren't really in place entirely. For instance, the Supreme Court, where I largely practice, The trouble is that you do not have all the files that have been filed over the years, all the cases being digitized. So in the absence of all pleadings having been digitized, it's very difficult to actually expect it to be without any trouble. So the new cases that are being filed are all being filed digitally. So it is fine to do that. But I think it'll take a huge overhaul of the records that are there presently in the courts across the country if this is going to be permanent or a semi-permanent feature, in the sense that if they are to continue with video conferencing, even in a post-COVID scenario, there has to be a huge process for digitizing records. But personally, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's allowed. I mean, in the present situation, something is better than nothing. Urgent cases have been heard. A lot of new cases have been heard by courts. And I think going forward as well, it can be adopted in cases where there might be an issue for people to travel.
That's really positive to hear. I want to now shift from talking about our courts, the NGT and the judiciary, to talking about the executive. There's been a recent draft notification on how we should go about with environmental impact assessments. Could you unpack this for us? Because it's been, again, flagged as a big concern where industrial priorities have been enhanced as opposed to environmental protection. Is there any merit in that? Could you tell us what's happening right now?
I think that, again, is a generalization. I think the draft notification, as its name suggests, is a draft. It's still calling for comments from the public. People can put in their comments, and in the past, comments have been considered. The draft notification, I think, has one clear positive. The first EIA notification came in the year 1994, and then another one came in 2006. The 2006 one was a major improvement from the 1994 one, in the sense that it was a little more comprehensive. It provided for a lot more things because it was a completely new concept in 1994. So a lot of things weren't known, weren't contemplated. By 2006, everyone had grown wiser. So a lot of things were added. But because of the sort of multitude of scenarios that one has to deal with in this area, because industries are of different kinds, they operate in different scenarios, there are always gray areas. So because of which the Ministry of Environment and Forests has over a period of time been issuing a lot of circulars, a lot of office memoranda, which we as lawyers, for instance, have to keep a compilation of. So at the moment that we at least close to 100 circulars and office memoranda that I have to look at apart from the EIA notification if I have to advise someone comprehensively. So what the draft EIA notification now does is to actually capture all those circulars and all those office memoranda into the one single document. So that is clearly a positive because you have a single comprehensive document that you can rely on and say that you've checked all corners to know whether you're complying with the law or not. There may be some merit in the criticisms, but I think at some point the attempt is to actually try and consolidate the different fora that an industry, for instance, has to go to obtain permissions. The attempt really seems to be that you get all your permissions largely under what is largely popularly called in government language is a single window clearance of sorts, which it isn't because the pollution control boards continue to operate separately. But the attempt largely is to streamline it so that you have all of them in one process.
Okay. But do you see any reduction per se in any environmental protections within the EIA framework, or is it largely the same as before? Whatever was before may not have been ideal, right? Either for the environment or for industries.
To me, actually, you know, this is not really the determinative factor. The determinative factor is on implementation. We've had the Air and Water Act much, much before the Environment Protection Act could come in and bring in this regime of environmental clearances. The problem area has been, in my experience, the implementation and the compliance, how far the pollution control boards, for instance, take that job as regulators, as opposed to only reacting to a situation after something goes wrong. So if they have an approach of proactively actually watching over industries that they give permissions to, I think a lot of problems could be solved. Similarly, with the EIA notification, it's not necessarily a problem. There is no dilution as such, but the proof of the pudding will be in really the implementation of how it is thereafter, how compliance is then regulated. And the Supreme Court has said this earlier in a case as well, that what you need is not a reactionary mechanism where the MOEF then penalizes someone, but you need a regulator as well, which I think needs to be introduced, and that will really reduce a lot of problems.
So unfortunately, it remains business as usual, and we remain stuck in this unhappy equilibrium on all those important questions. Ninad, my final question to you is, given the current political and economic climate, right, there's been an attempt by several states to woo foreign industries and foreign manufacturing to come to India. We do have a big economic crisis that we need to figure out how to climb out of. Do you see hope for that environmental regulator coming in the foreseeable future, in the next couple of years? Do you see scope for better environmental protections in parallel with promotion of industrial activity and development in our country?
I think there is hope, because I see that largely the problem has been of things escaping people, or people consciously letting them escape them, in the sense that if you have to take permissions from five different authorities and you take from four and not five, it may be an oversight or it may be conscious. So one good prime example that I can think of where in the past this problem has been solved is the tourism industry, for instance, for setting up five-star resorts in coastal areas. There is one set of laws called the Coastal Zone Regulations, and there is, of course, the EIA notification. What they did is in 2011, they fused the two, and they said that if a project requires both, they will go into a single process. So which is why there is no opportunity then for someone to either overlook the permission that they ought to have taken, and similarly, no authority also misses out. So I think that's the way forward. And I think if there is going to be any further reform to encourage industry at the same time maintaining environmental standards, the way forward would be to fuse permissions, to bring them under one umbrella, so that there is no opportunity for anyone to overlook any mandatory permissions.
Ninad, thank you so much for taking the time and coming back to the Pragati podcast for our World Environment Day episode, and for shedding light on what's happening, especially over the last 2 years. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pavan. It was a pleasure, just as the last time, and I look forward to more.
Thank you for listening in. I want to tell all of you that the draft Environmental Impact Assessment notification is open for public comments and inputs till June 30th, 2020. And I'd encourage all of you to read the notification and write into the government to suggest any changes that you think are necessary. You can find all relevant links and more about the episode at tinyurl.com/pragati140. I also want to make a small correction. Maya Ramesh wrote her article on the NGT losing its teeth first in Monga Bay, and it was subsequently republished on The Wire. And now, on to our episode from December 2018 with Ninad, which is perfect listening for getting the correct context on how environmental law and the role of our courts has evolved over the last two decades. More after a short break.
नमस्ते, मैं हूँ सौरभ चंद्रा.
और मैं प्रणय कोटस्थाने.
जब महफिल खत्म होते होते दरवाजे के बाहर पुलिया के ऊपर हम दुनिया भर की जटिल समस्याओं को सॉल्व करने में लग जाते हैं, तो हो जाती है पुलियाबाजी.
अब आजकल के अपार्टमेंट वालों ने तो कभी पुलिया देखी नहीं होगी, पर आप फीलिंग तो समझ ही सकते हैं.
तो आइए शामिल हो जाइए हमारी पुलियाबाजी में, जहां प्रणय और मैं एक से एक इंटरेस्टिंग टॉपिक्स की तह तक जाएंगे.
आर्टिफिशियल इंटेलिजेंस, बिटकॉइन, पाकिस्तान, मेडिकल एजुकेशन, करेंसी क्राइसिस, कभी हम दोनों के साथ और अक्सर स्पेशल एक्सपर्ट गेस्ट की कंपनी में.
सुनिए हमें IVM की वेबसाइट, ऐप या अपने फेवरेट पॉडकास्टिंग प्लेटफॉर्म पर हर दूसरे हफ्ते.
Welcome back. Hi, Ninad. Welcome to the Pragati podcast. It's my absolute pleasure to have you here. I'm glad that I could come to Delhi and have you come into studio to talk to me about a lot of things related to the environment and law today.
Hi, Pavan. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
So, Ninad, I want to start by saying that, you know, in India, we've seen rapid economic growth and associated development, a lot of positive things that have happened in the country, a lot of lives being transformed in the last 30 years at a pace that was not there before. But in this process, we've also seen our environment in India face new challenges. And sometimes these environmental challenges become human challenges as well, right? Because
yes.
If we call air pollution an environmental challenge, it's as much a health challenge as anything else. But sometimes it is human, sometimes it is sort of intrinsic nature, it's some other group. And often people have gone to the courts in order to step in and provide a solution. And
to be perhaps this has happened at the same time when public interest litigation has also become a much bigger thing in the country, and PILs have been one weapon in the arsenal of someone who's trying to save the environment. So can you tell me a little about PILs and this, and we'll start from there?
Yeah, so PILs are actually the court exercising its powers, which it always had, which is called writ jurisdiction, which only the high courts and the Supreme Court have. PILs were sort of invented, if I may say so, so that people who would otherwise find it difficult to approach the court could approach it even by means of a letter. In fact, one of the sort of celebrated precedents of the use of PILs was a letter written by someone who was in custody about the the conditions in custody, and that was one of the celebrated cases in the Supreme Court. But over time, of course, access became easier, since it was known that virtually anyone could come to the Supreme Court. And in general,
tell me how this works, because again, I'm coming in as someone who's never actually had to go to a court, thankfully. So one, if you're an aggrieved party, I mean, something's happened to me. I feel like there's a civil matter or a criminal matter where I'm a victim or I've been wronged. I can go to the police and I can mostly go to a court and file a case, right? But I don't need to be an aggrieved party when it's a PIL?
Yes. So, that's what I was saying. It was very loose and very sort of broad when it began. But with time, I mean, it's pretty obvious that there was abuse. There was misuse of it. So eventually the Supreme Court in a particular case laid down guidelines, which is called the Balwant Singh Chauffal case, because someone came up with a really ridiculous plea that someone to be an advocate general of a state cannot be over a certain age. So the court was really peeved by the fact that such issues, any sort of issues being picked up as a public interest litigation, and you know, this is not something that should get priority. So they laid down rules, which they then asked the high courts to adopt as their statutory rules. So the high courts have adopted those rules, in which a person who files a PIL now needs to declare that he has no private interest in this particular issue, et cetera, et cetera. So now it's a little more defined, a little more narrowed down, but it doesn't mean it stops people from setting up someone to file a PIL, et cetera.
Okay. So a notional nonprofit or anyone else can say that, look, this is an issue that is of public interest.
Yes.
And I want to represent those who cannot come to court and fight.
Yes.
And I want to bring this matter to court.
In fact, there's been precedent where, someone who filed a particular PIL decided then to withdraw it. And the court said, we think that the issue is too important for it to depend on you. So we let you go, but we'll appoint an amicus, which is like a friend of the court, a lawyer, and we'll carry on with the case. So,
wow.
So that's how this jurisprudence has been evolving.
Can courts decide also to sort of
do it on their own?
Yeah, suo moto.
Yes, they do. Yeah, suo moto is pretty common, actually. It's happened in the Supreme Court before. It's happened in various high courts before. So, for instance, presently there's a particular case that's going on in the Supreme Court, which is a suo moto petition by court number 2 presently, when they read about certain deaths due to dengue in Delhi. And it turns out that the news report suggested it was because of the construction sites and how water was being handled there, etc. So they used that news report and then they issued notices to all state governments for not enforcing the solid waste management rules. And eventually they even passed an order saying unless you enforce these rules, no construction activity would go on in your state. So they stopped construction activity altogether in 2 states.
Wow.
So, yes, that's probably the latest precedent of a suo moto exercise by the court.
Wow. Okay. So now PILs, of course, they're all public interest, right? I mean, they're not just the environment.
Yes.
But tell us about how you have seen interesting cases over the last, I don't know, so many years about the environment. I mean, what have been interesting things that have happened?
Yeah, so the environmental public interest litigation in the Supreme Court started with sort of 2 strands. One was this environmentalist, Mr. M.C. Mehta, who you might have probably heard of. He and one Mr. T.N. Godavarman. These are 2 sort of cases, or rather now they are labels that are used, in which, you know, the Supreme Court, seeing the difficulty of people coming separately, decided to carry on these 2 cases in a manner that people could file applications in those cases and come to the court. And So they developed through the 90s then something called as the Forest Bench, which was typically headed by the Chief Justice of the country with a couple of other judges. Okay. And they are the ones who started passing orders on protection of forests, etc., green areas, so on and so forth. And that went on until that the bench was done away with only about 3 years back. But it's not as if those matters are done. A lot of those matters after 2010 were sent to the NGT, because the NGT was created only in 2010.
This is the National Green
Tribunal. So a lot of cases were sent there, but others continue to be in the Supreme Court. So what they did is, through these two cases, they sort of monitored how statutory authorities were functioning, who ought to have done their job. So you have something called the Pollution Control Board in every state, and you have the Ministry of Environment and Forests of the center, which is sort of, loosely speaking, a monitoring body for all of these pollution control boards as well, though they operate under two separate statutes. You have something called as the Air Prevention of Pollution Act and Water Prevention of Pollution Act, under which directly the pollution control boards function, whereas the MOEF sort of administers everything under the Environment Protection Act and the rules they're under. So,
and even within this, even state governments have their own forestry department.
Yes, they have their own forest department as well. Yes. So the Forest Conservation Act is another aspect, which was sort of the trigger point for all these PILs actually in the Supreme Court. Okay. So you've also had a case where two judges were going somewhere and they found that, you know, there were these hoardings being put up in the forests, and as a result, trees were being cut. They took up something suo moto. So it started with forests.
It feels so anecdotal, some of the starting points.
Yes, it is. So, yeah, that's how it's gone through a long journey. I think they've surely done, they were necessary. It was good that they happened. The question is, how could they have really been carried on? And, you know, a lot of questions have been asked about it. So that's probably one of the reasons why it was sort of done away with. The Forest Bench as such, as it stood with that name, doesn't exist anymore.
Can you help me understand how, when the law, the judiciary even looks at the environment as such? I mean, what are the laws? Like you said, there's a clean air and clean water legislation. There's a Forest Rights Act.
Yes.
There are coastal regulations that have come
in. Yes.
So how, broadly, what are the big things that are there
so
legally?
So the two big things really are whether people are even applying for statutory permissions before they begin operations.
Okay.
That's one aspect of the matter. The other is enforcement. Because to be frank, until about a decade or more back, even if people took permissions, they weren't really following the conditions. So when you set up a new industry, you need to take something called as a consent to establish from your state pollution control board. And then you get something called as a consent to operate, which has very clear conditions laid down. And those conditions then are not sort of creations of the pollution control boards. Those are actually provided in what is called the environment protection rules. And these are very specific conditions on what should be the particulate matter, if it's an industry that will probably pollute the air, you know, if it's going to be a water discharge, what sort of discharge is permissible, what is not, where, how it's got to be treated, all of it is all there. The issue really was that these were all things on paper. And the court really stepped in, apart from the issue of forests, which was a little more undefined, because when it comes to forests, there's the Forest Conservation Act. But what is a forest was a big issue. So the Supreme Court has actually gone on in one of the cases, T.N. Godavarman, gone on to force state governments to set up committees of bureaucrats and environmentalists to together define what a forest would be in their respective states. Okay. So that forest could be identified and further felling of trees could be stopped post the identification, which is being done largely now. So that was one aspect of the matter, the forest. One was the non-application for permissions. People would operate without permissions. And the third is, even after they had permissions, which is something which the National Green Tribunal later has sort of taken the role from the Supreme Court, which we'll come to. I mean,
so in this, it's sort of, tell me if I'm reading this right. Mm-hmm. Basically, the legislature at the state and the central level have put in a bunch of laws in place. The laws have a bunch of details, but the executive never took them forward and sort of had put any real regulatory teeth on a lot of them. And the mechanism was that the judiciary stepped in.
Yes, I think the teeth, again, were then on paper. The issue was, these were things that were done as if it was, you know, it was like buying a ticket for a cinema hall. You got it and then you walked in and that was the end of it. So people applied, got it, went about it. There was no monitoring. Boards wouldn't typically check if someone was polluting or not thereafter, if they were actually complying with the conditions that are being put in, etc.
So it was like an entry ticket, yes, where there is a legal price for the entry ticket and
yes,
extra.
So people sort of did, you know, textbook compliance. They went ahead, applied, got. But then after that, sort of, they knew they had it, so they wouldn't bother about anything more.
So this is like a radically different thing from the license Raj, when someone could count the number of Bajaj scooters that would come out of a factory. Now all the way to the other side, where
yes,
once a factory is set up, doesn't matter what they're yes, putting out into the air or the water, they're off doing their own thing.
Yeah.
So how far did PIS help in this? So it's weird, right? Because the executive has to do this. There have to be regulators, inspectors, and the whole system. And here are judges who are sitting on the outside, however informed and whatever, however they direct. What happens?
Yeah. So have they helped? The answer is clearly yes. But as I said, I mean, how should they be going about this? And, you know, how have they gone about it? The trouble really has been that, you know, even with these two cases that I mentioned, which are sort of the main two streams of PILs in the Supreme Court on environment, MC Mehta and Godavarman, beyond a point, it sort of became a case of micromanagement. You know, a particular sawmill or a particular industry, the smallest of it, had to come to the Supreme Court then to sort of, you know, clarify and things like that. And, you know, the Supreme Court has got a lot of more important work to do. Mainly it's constitutional work that it has, apart from being the appellate court for everything in India, because India's got a peculiar Supreme Court compared to the rest of the world, that where anything from a landlord-tenant dispute to a service dispute to anything and everything apart from constitutional issues all land up in the Supreme Court as long as someone's willing to come. So with the amount of litigation that is already there in the Supreme Court, to then spare time for each of these was one big issue. The second was what was the issues of expertise. So the Supreme Court came up with, or rather constituted, something called as a Central Empowered Committee, which is again a mix of environmentalists and bureaucrats, to sort of give them a report on things. But it wasn't, again, satisfactory, because this was a parallel sort of regime. You already had a statutory regime. So it's worked well to a certain extent. I think it surely played one role. These PILs played a very good role, is that of awareness. So the general public became aware of their rights vis-a-vis the environment, plus industry was aware that there was something called compliance with environmental laws, which a lot of them were unaware. I mean, I'll give you a very good instance. You must have heard the word environmental clearance,
yes,
sometime or the other. This is something that first came up in 1994 by a notification in the Environment Protection Act, and now it exists under a 2006 notification. For the longest time, from 94 till about 2004-05, people weren't aware that something like this existed. People were confused whether they had to apply for it or not. So at that point, the Supreme Court took a very pragmatic approach. And on one given day when the MOEF sort of woke up, you know, 1994 till about 2004, they'd done nothing. They suddenly woke up one day and shut down everyone, saying that you've not applied for this. So wow, about 150 or more industries were shut down. A lot of them rushed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court took a pragmatic approach by saying that, well, there seems to be some gray area whether, you know, you ought to have applied or not, whether an existing industry that was already operating before 94 had to apply or not. So we'll give you time. They said, everyone apply now. And then they monitored it for a while and they said, if you've got it now, carry on. If you've not, then you stop. So okay, that was sort of a good balanced approach.
What kind of industries were this? I mean,
these were, I mean, a huge number of mining industries. And in fact, the Supreme Court was sort of compelled to take a more pragmatic approach because the coal mines were also involved, which would have meant, you know, a huge cascading effect if they'd all been shut down because of power and all of that. So, but yeah, a lot of other industries. So there was a huge number. I mean, I can't remember the exact, but it's clearly more than 150 that were shut down by one particular order of the ministry. So
it's amazing that one order can do that. And that's terrifying. Yes. Things like this frame this environment versus development debate that goes nuts after a time, right? Oh, the environment lobby coming and banning things, and no, but we are doing development and we're building coal, we're mining yes, coal for the country, and which is a very bizarre dichotomy to me, right?
Yes.
Okay, so one, there's so much power, so much lack of clarity, and the courts do intervene, not necessarily just by banning things and so on, but they're essentially doing conflict resolution between the state and the industry.
To a certain extent, right? As well, yes.
It's amazing that one court has to do all of this.
Yes, I think that was the problem, and that is why really they thought of the National Green Tribunal, as I mentioned earlier. So, but just before that, I think the trouble really with the PILs, and that's been the larger criticism that the Supreme Court has been under, is that though it obviously is a very well-intentioned thing, the PILs that started on the environmental fear and then carried on, is that you see, because of paucity of time, because of perhaps not lack of expertise, but, you know, I mean, not everyone's trained in every, you know, specialization that every industry might operate into to know the nuances of every industry. Even if the intention is right, there is a tendency at times to come up with a broad brush, quick solution to things. So the court tends to sometimes pass orders which are easier for them to pass, easier for them to enforce. But what happens there is that you aren't necessarily damaging or you aren't necessarily stopping the polluter or the actual violator. You also end up with that broad brush affecting people who've done no wrong. So I think that's a major problem with the whole PIL, you know, way of functioning when it comes to environmental regulation. So it all sounds fine. It's easier to understand post a judgment that this is allowed, this is not allowed. But the trouble is, you know, the court doesn't possibly have the time to get into each individual case to know what they've done and what they've not done. And, you know, sometimes it would rely on government authority to report on that. Government authorities, again, may not be able to assist. So the court then, you know, wants to err on the side of caution. So it would err to stop an entire industry, for instance. So that's happened before. And we've seen that happening. A lot of people would say that even with mining, that's happened. I mean, again, necessary, very necessary interventions. But the question is, who is the real culprit and who suffered? That's a big question mark that remains.
We'll be back with Ninad after this short break. Welcome back.
Ninad, so how effective was the Supreme Court or other courts in pushing the government to actually set up systems that could actually do the governance that was necessary? Because we've heard of a TRAI in the telecom sector, right? We have a telecom regulator. We don't really have an environment-related regulator, right? We have a ministry, we have departments. Yes, there is a pollution control board. Fine, I mean, there's that. But we don't have necessarily anything with the teeth and the depth of something like the Environment Protection Agency of the U.S. And you need that that expertise and that regulatory apparatus to be able to do something, right? So did the court succeed after these?
Yeah, so the court actually in about 2014 finally said that precisely what you just raised, which is that you have everything in place. And by that time, the NGT also existed. However, it still said that there is no regulator. So they said you need an independent regulator, set it up. Unfortunately, it's yet to be set up. So that remains. But yes, there's a judgment of the Supreme Court asking them to set it up. I think they've just been sort of taking time over it. But it's not yet been set up to the best of my information.
So now in all of this, so with all this PIL taking up so much time of the court, it's supposed to deal with constitutional matters and not necessarily important developmental conflicts, but they're still not constitutional matters, right? They're not even appellate matters. How did the NGT, the National Green Tribunal, come about? How was this institution created? And give us a little context on what this is in relation to all the various courts that we have in the country.
So as I was saying earlier, when you asked me what is this environmental PILs about, I said there are two aspects. One is whether you've taken permission. The other is whether what you do post the permission. And then there's a third, which is a broader one with the court. The Supreme Court has basically looked at something, whether it should be banned. For instance, you said, like, they went at air pollution and they said the public transport in Delhi will be only CNG, et cetera, et cetera. So these are three different things. What's happened now is, initially, they set up something called as the Environmental Appellate Tribunal, which didn't sort of take off really well. And then in 2010, they came up with the NGT. Now, the role of the NGT is basically to take off the shelf of the Supreme Court to lighten the burden of the Supreme Court by taking off two aspects. One is taking off permissions. The second is post-permission monitoring. If you violate the law, even post-taking permission, or you operate without a permission, or even if you're granted a permission, when you could not have been granted a permission, all these aspects have now been expressly put in the statute in the National Green Tribunal Act of 2010 and given to the NGT. So that is what the NGT was set up for and has been doing.
So can you tell me a little bit about the shape and size of this entity?
Yeah, so this NGT...
I sit in Bangalore, right? So NGT is just a name. We've heard of Justice Swatantra Kumar. But I don't know anything more.
I think you heard his name for good reason because you see, the institution started off not too well. It took some time before it could really pick up. When I say pick up is to be noticed, to make a difference to people. So what Justice Swatantra Kumar really has done, did after taking over, and I think all credit to him is he's really built an institution. It was because of him that today, I think the entire country is largely more aware about environmental law. I would say people who would otherwise violate with impunity are today a little more circumspect. And, you know, he also made it a point actually to set up, it was his initiative to set up zonal benches. So you have one bench in Chennai, which deals with southern India cases. You have one bench in Bhopal, which deals with central India cases. You have one bench in Pune, which deals with western India cases. And you have one in Calcutta that deals with eastern India cases. So this is a very good system in place.
And so it's not just in Delhi?
No. So the Delhi seat is actually only the principal seat that deals with northern India cases. So that's how it is meant to be, of course. And unfortunately, though, I mean, things aren't the same anymore. After his retirement, there seems to be some strange sort of inertia with the government. They first took quite some time to appoint a chairman in his place. And by that time, actually, there were many more retirements that happened. So the structure of the NGT, as the statute itself provides, is that every case, you know, like with all tribunals, what's the purpose of setting up the tribunals? To lessen the burden of the high courts that were otherwise being clogged with these cases. So, and the essential difference between a court and a tribunal is that the tribunal will typically have a mix of legally trained minds and experts. So the NGT is actually designed in such a way that every case is to be heard by equal number of judges and experts. Okay. So if you're going to have the tribunal in Delhi and those other five benches that I mentioned, they need to have five judges always, and they need to have five experts so that they can sit in a combination of, you know, one expert and one judge in all these places. But unfortunately, a lot of those experts had retired, a lot of the judges retired, and strangely, from Feb to about July, nobody was appointed. Then the chairman was appointed in July. But sadly, since then, there has been, the other vacancies haven't been filled up. So today they have five judges, but they have only two experts. Now, what that means is that none of the zonal benches are functional. So they have a stopgap arrangement to have something called as video conferencing. So if you have a case in, let's say, Chennai, you have to wait for your turn a particular day of the week. They will hear you from Delhi, where you are arguing from Chennai over video conferencing, which is, well, it's a welcome step. At least something's better than nothing. But then I per se find it discriminatory. Why should it be that someone in Delhi can move the court immediately the next day, whereas someone in Chennai, someone in Bhopal has to wait for his turn, and that too, he'll be heard? I mean, all said and done, it's not the same thing to be heard over video conferencing as opposed to being actually there in person.
You can't necessarily be as persuasive in the argument.
Yes, I mean, one can say both things, but then I think, at least as a lawyer, I find it, you feel a little constrained if you have to do it. I've personally never done it because I'm based here. But I think, you know, there is good reason to believe that it's not a satisfactory situation. And what's strange is now they have the number of judges. All they need is three more experts. I fail to see why it's taken so long. So, in fact, the Supreme Court is now looking into this as to why they've not appointed it. But it surely, I mean, points towards probably a lack of intent, or it's just apathy. I mean, it's taken that long. The trouble is people are, you know, people who felt or looked up to the NGT all this while in terms of its accessibility surely don't feel the same anymore.
Permit me to ask a few dumb questions. So each bench is five judges here?
No. Each bench must have a minimum of one judge and one expert.
Okay.
So that's
And there has to be a bench in all the five parts of the country.
That's how it functioned till Justice Swatantra Kumar was there.
Okay.
And we expected that those were systems put in place so it would go. The act allows for that. The legislation allows for the chairman to set up benches, and he did set up these four benches. And I think it was a happy situation for everyone in terms of access. So it really became an alternative. People stopped going to the high courts, etc. even coming to the Supreme Court. Because, you know, it's not very easy for anyone from everywhere to reach the Supreme Court with their PILs and so on and so forth. So
now, can you tell me a little more about who an expert was in this case who helped the judge?
So the experts that they have, typically either people with an environmental background or they are bureaucrats who worked in the planning sort of aspect of the bureaucracy. So someone who's either been in the planning commission or someone who's been in, you know, or in a pollution control board himself or in, you know, some other central authority that's been overseeing urban planning, etc. Because these are issues that come up and, you know, they obviously are better equipped than any legally trained mind, unless you've, I mean, we've been fortunate to be acquainted with a particular area of industry or.
So would experts also include, say, people who worked in the industry and understand?
We've not had a precedent so far for that.
Okay.
Not to the best of my information. So far, I think they've been a mix of environmentalists. I mean, not environmentalists, but people who worked in organizations that dealt with environment, be it government or semi-government, and bureaucrats. And I think that it does, I mean, from the perspective of a lawyer having argued, we find that there is definitely that advantage of having them on the bench, for sure. I mean, that's a huge benefit to actually deal with, because there's a good element of technicality in all these environmental matters, especially to understand both perspectives.
So there are legal nuances and technical nuances
that both
have to come in.
Absolutely.
And so could you give me some examples? So it's really sad to hear that this new institution, which was supposed to be a part of the solution, I don't know, has been staffed poorly and not been able to do all of its work. But could you tell me a little about the kind of cases the NGT might have heard and the kind of decisions, just to for me to get a sense of the kinds of issues that were dealt with, important ones from the last years. I have a couple that I've come across only vaguely sitting in Bangalore, but I'd like to hear more.
The NGT has dealt with a lot of cases of, you know, the most sort of typical case that will come to the NGT is, or more the Northern Bench and some other benches is where a large industry is not complying with the conditions in the consent that it has from the Pollution Control Board. So it's done it, for instance, there's been an instance of a huge industry being fined but allowed to operate and to put in place systems before it can operate. Recently, there have been cases about river pollution being caused by industries which were asked again to shut down, and only if they could put certain environmental safeguards or control systems in place, they were allowed to operate. The Western Bench, for instance, has had a lot of cases on coastal regulation zone, because that's a major issue out there. You know, rapid construction is happening haphazardly. And I think one of the major deterrents is the coastal regulation zone, because you can't. So a major bone of contention there is the age of your construction, because the regulations came in 91. So if you built them before, then you're probably through. But if you've not built it subsequently, then it's illegal. So the NGT has actually been very stern, has in fact demolished a lot of structures that they found were built after 91 and, you know, were without permissions. And it's not really stopped from shutting down, but never permanent shutdown that I know of, where it's permanently shut down something. Perhaps certain kind of industries have seen something to do with brick kilns, etc., which, or from, you know, the vicinity of residential areas, they've forced them to move away, etc.
But, you know, as you're saying all of these things to me, they all still feel like the least worst option that is available, right? This is still the judiciary stepping in where there has been abject executive failure.
Yes.
To me. Because, you know, the challenge that I see when a legal response has to come to some of these problems is that it can be one size fits all sometimes, right? Especially when, and with very complex systems, we want decentralized solutions to address the problems of that area. So I come from Bangalore. We have a city full of former lakes. How most of them are disappearing. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, there were PILs moved in the last decade where they said that, look, lakes are being encroached, real estate companies, others sort of coming and taking this over. So there should be some protection. So if I'm not mistaken, either the Supreme Court or the NGT ruled that, you know, within prior construction, notwithstanding any new construction, within 30 meters of the identified boundary, I think, of a lake, you shall not have any construction. And now something like this is extremely problematic, because good intention, I understand, I fully agree that lake borders must be preserved. but maybe there are some places in which some part has already been lost. So you need executive action, and how do you get that back, right? Say the government has allowed someone to construct, then the government should be able to buy it back or figure out some negotiation with, say, a wetland that was feeding into a lake, right? So now that's something that no one wants to do, so we'll leave that out. But say, again, going back to Bangalore, there are so many suburbs where there were little villages that all get gobbled up as the city expands. And these little villages don't necessarily have the same infrastructure and facilities that, you know, the richer, better planned areas have. And, you know, and sometimes they have a traditional link with the local ecosystem and the lakes, which now get disrupted by this kind of a one solution. Right? I mean, for example, there were people who were suffering from open defecation. The lake was one area where there was open space available. Now, the lake has a fence and a 30-meter rule. But the same local residents need sanitation solutions. And now no one can build a concrete sanitation community toilet within 30 meters of that lake because of a Supreme Court order. And to me, it's...
Yeah, I think this is a classic...
boggles the mind.
This is, I think, a classic case of where... I mean, I'm not aware of the particular facts of this case, but the Environment Protection Act and the Environment Protection Rules contemplate the ministry enforcing certain restrictions on particular kind of industries from the vicinity of certain ecologically sensitive areas such as national parks, wildlife sanctuaries, water bodies, etc. So this could surely have been dealt with correctly had the government stepped in and done this. Because when the government does it, the statute requires it to hear out people who have objections to this, to consider what would be the impact of such restrictions on people in local habitation, etc. Now, because this has not been done, it's compelled someone to go file a PIL. And I'm not surprised that, you know, the court has obviously found, as you called it, a one-size-fits-all solution to this problem. So that's the most common vicious circle that we have in environmental litigation, or had this before the NGT came in, which was that because there was executive apathy, people went to court and then the court came up with some solution. So,
and now if you actually want to overturn a court solution, you need a larger bench set up to do it.
If it's a Supreme Court order that you're mentioning, then of course, yes.
So it's a very, very high bar.
Yes.
Even otherwise, you have to appeal to a higher court, right? Whereas executive, the idea is that you have quicker correction.
Yeah.
You come up with a set of rules, you get inputs, you will modify the rules. So long as the rules comply with the overarching legislation, you're fine, right? And so this is the least worst option. This is what we get because our governments have failed us and we have not held our governments to account.
Absolutely. I think the overarching theme really that I can see in all of how environmental law in India has developed is that we always had, it's not as if we did not have enough laws in place, like with every other subject, not just environment. The trouble was the seriousness attached to it by the government, and as a result, the intent of the government in actually enforcing it. And, you know, it's only the seriousness of the government in enforcing a law is what will percolate as, you know, information to the citizens and awareness among citizens to actually follow and comply with it. And so this is how things have come to where they are, where the court has had to step in. And yes, there are times when it's unsatisfactory, the court's intervention. But as I said, I mean, it was at least initially very necessary. Today, I think, you know, now that we have systems in place, at least the NGT is in place, the regulator is yet to come up, which I think would solve a lot of these issues, like you mentioned, because of lack as some sort of in-between, really, that to avoid such situations, you know. In fact, the court, when it asked the government to set up this regulator, it said the trouble is that every case that is coming to us is a post-facto scenario where someone's already done something, the damage is already done, and then we are wondering whether we should allow this or not. And we have to take pragmatic, you know, decisions in allowing them to continue because you allowed them to continue. So there's a classic case, for instance, from the outskirts of Mumbai, where there's a massive industry that came up. And one fine day, after about 3 decades, the government of Maharashtra woke up and said, oh, this is, by the way, a forest. So the Supreme Court said, I mean, you can't possibly do this to them because you've given them every building permission that they obtained before building anything that they did. Today, it's a huge, huge, huge industry. We are not going to shut it down. So, I mean, that's the kind of decision what does, I mean, it's not a happy situation for anyone. I mean, if it was really a forest, it should have been preserved, then it's a sad situation. But then can you blame the industry? You can't. So yeah, a citizen can only do as much as he's told to do.
And you know, this is so striking for me, you know, coming from Bangalore, because the writ of the government paper is so weak, right? A government gives you an approval saying you can build a 5-story apartment here. They've given the permission, I mean, obtained whatever, but the government has signed off on it. And then 5 years later, they come and say, no, there is a drainage canal running through. You cannot have any construction here. Demolish. It's not fair to the people who built this. It's not fair to anyone. It's not fair to the drainage system and those who get affected by the flooding as a result of the lack of that drainage system. But these are the kind of sort of ugly, wicked situations that we have let ourselves come to.
Yeah. This is, I think, another problem is that, you know, you have legislations for construction, which is a separate one. You have an environmental legislation that is another distinct legislation. So you aren't necessarily forced to go, you know, through all of them together. If you did have to go through them together, something like what you mentioned would probably not happen.
And I want to ask your opinion on one related matter, is that we seem to have some kind of regulators coming up, at least at the national level, right? So we've always had the RBI, mm-hmm. have a SEBI, and slowly, sector by sector, I think there is this recognition that, yes, there was a ministry, yes, there were PSUs, but now you need this independent authority. And often they're not given 100% independence, but you need a regulator who's as independent as they can.
Plays a role.
Who can adjudicate, do conflict resolution, come up with new rules, help people figure out what the game is, right? The rules of the game need to be known.
Absolutely.
Before you can ask players to say, play the game well and don't cheat. And do you see that happening at all at the state level, where a lot of these environmental regulations really, you know?
Well, I think there's been a bit of a war, so to say, that's been happening, in the sense that the main sort of bible for all environmental permissions is something called as the Environment Impact Assessment Notification, and the government has in the last 3 years sought to amend it more than once to try and fuse building permissions with environmental safeguards. I think that intention is right, but then the National Green Tribunal saw it as a device to, and the Supreme Court rather saw it as a device, the National Green Tribunal first, and the Supreme Court agreed that it seemed like a device to do away with the requirements of having sort of stringent conditions being put in by pollution control boards and the Ministry of Environment and Forests, and to sort of make it easier to get permissions which won't be sort of scrutinized in with the same level that it presently is. So, in fact, there's another amendment that's just come in, you know, just a couple of weeks back, by which it's the environmental permissions and the building permissions have been fused, at least for, you know, housing, etc. And that's been challenged in the Delhi High Court, and the Delhi High Court has stayed it. So the battle continues. So I think we need to reach a balance where we can have this one sort of cohesive process by which all safeguards are taken into consideration. At the same time, it can't be at the cost of doing away with one of the safeguards, which I think is necessary, which is the environmental concerns.
You know, I have colleagues and others who I've listened to who have said things like, you know, environmental laws and regulations are the luxury of the rich. You know, we should grow quickly as a country. And then once we've achieved a certain level, then we'll bring in, you know, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And we are a poor country with developmental challenges where these are in the way. Is that something you'd agree with?
Or? Certainly not. I think this, all these legislations are very much necessary. I think my assessment of this whole thing, if I could just sum it up in two lines really, is that I think you need these environmental legislations. What you need is their enforcement. What we do not need is a sort of straitjacket formula being applied without really looking at individual facts, etc., which is, I think, courts are compelled, unfortunately, to adopt. I think that's not a happy scenario. So I think as long as we have sort of more clear enforcement of what is already in place, I think we'd do well.
And it's not about waiting for 20 years and 30 years.
No, I don't think so. I think development can go on while having safeguards. You know, you might set up the largest industry, but you can't possibly suggest that an industry should get a free hand to not follow any of the norms, for instance, of air pollution. I mean, as someone living in Delhi, I surely cannot suggest that. I mean, we are suffering. We are suffering for what reason? I mean, that's, again, a very, very interesting situation because, you know, I don't think there's yet a very clear study as to who's the main culprit. So some would say, and if you go by court orders, it would appear that it's vehicular pollution. Some would say it's the crop burning in Punjab. And if that is the case, why is nothing yet being done about it? And why do we have a repeat this year is again, I mean, quite surprising. So, so you know, until this, we're in a process where the sort of battle goes on, and especially with air pollution in Delhi, we've had the NGT and the Supreme Court both acting. And of course, we had in between the odd and even thing, which I personally think was absolutely illogical. So, you know, solution has to be a solution after considering it holistically. I think you can't have, the trouble is there is a tendency to sometimes probably go into symbolism to have something that looks like a quick fix. So, yeah, that's that.
And it's really the challenge. I mean, we've seen cities come into the national sort of political discussion only in the last 10, 15 years. We've seen health becoming a political issue only in the last year or two. But environment has always been framed as a very antagonistic debate in India, where there are some people who are environmentalists and activists, and then there are the rest who are trying to, who are industrialists. But maybe the hope is for, if our governance needs to be proactive and our regulatory systems need to be proactive, there has to be a very different political conversation and a public conversation around.
I think development, you know, versus environment is an oversimplified question. I mean, that's not the question at all. I think there's no doubt that development should happen, but I think it cannot be at the cost of the environment. And I think it's not that difficult. What I find strange is that, I mean, it needs a change in attitude, perhaps also for industry, that they need to follow, you know, things that they need to follow as conditions to operate their industry. And I think if once that consciousness is there, it percolates down to the industry that if they have to survive, they have to do that. I think we would have achieved a lot.
On that note of cautious optimism, Anina, thank you so much for coming on the Pragati podcast. It was a pleasure to have you. I hope to have you again on the show before too long.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for staying with us till the end. If you have any questions or comments, do write in to podcast@thinkpragati.com. And hey, if you like the podcast and listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. It'll mean a lot to us. The Pragati podcast is available on the IVM podcast app and pretty much every other podcast app and platform. We are there everywhere.